And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay interview.
Hello, everyone. If you follow my interviews closely, you'll know that I'm now presenting the McKay interview mini-series in three parts on America Today. This is the third and final part. The basis of the series is my curiosity about America, especially today's America. But because I'm no expert, I've called on the help of three longtime, knowledgeable American friends of quite different professional experiences to help me examine the state of their country as they see it through their own eyes. Now, my final guest is an American who actually lives in the USA, though he lived much of his professional life outside of his home country as a career diplomat. My first two guests, if you tuned in to listen, were American expatriates. What my three guests have in common is they're all friends of mine, the integrity of whose opinions I trust, and they're all Americans of a similar generation, my generation. They've been around a long time and can take the really long view. And as I've said before, speaking as a non-American, many of us admire the United States greatly, warts and all. But in recent times, that country seems, to many of us who watch from a distance, to have faltered, stumbled. A country not really at peace with itself, vast, energetic, and talented, though it undoubtedly is. Because the health of the globe's only superpower is important to the world, especially what we in the West call the free world, is to be hoped and desired that America pulls itself together and sooner rather than later. The new president, Joe Biden, has gone on record already as saying America is back. And so I'm going to ask my guest today, as I did the two previous ones, his opinion about where America is now and how it got there. I mean, the end of the Trump era and the beginning of Biden's, why the turmoil and rancor across the land that culminated in the defeat of Trump on the 4th of November last year, why so many millions of Americans believed last November's election was stolen, to use the word of the man who lost, and if time allows, other domestic topics and foreign affairs. My guest today is more than qualified to give us disinterested insights and perspectives. He was last on my show in 2016, just 1 week after the election of Donald Trump. Well, much has happened since then. The Honorable Kent Brown is a former United States ambassador to the Republic of Georgia, a strategically located state in the Caucasus region of Eurasia. If I'm not mistaken, he was the very first ambassador in Tbilisi after the collapse of the Soviet Union. He was also once the consul general at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. His diplomatic career serving the United States spanned almost 30 years, including postings in Panama, Trinidad and Tobago, Prague, Moscow before the end of the Cold War, Rome, Washington, D.C., the NATO headquarters in Brussels, and finally Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia. And after leaving the State Department, Kent Brown lived for a while in Geneva, where we worked together for the same company as colleagues. He now lives in Florida, from where he joins me today via Skype. Hello, Kent. Welcome to the McKay interview.
Well, Michael, thank you very much for the invitation to be on your program, which I think is a fantastic program.
Thank you.
Believe it or not, I quite often listen to it, especially when you're talking about America. But anyway, it's very good to be here. My best greetings to all of your listeners, those in Switzerland and elsewhere. And I'm very proud to have an opportunity to air my views.
Great. Thanks, Ken. Ken, let's start with exactly the same question that I put to both Dr. Danny Warner and John Wood a few weeks ago. Context. Context, an overworked word these days, but you and I are the same generation, remember well the upheavals of the 1960s and early 70s, the Vietnam War, the race riots in America's major cities, civil rights, the student unrest on university campuses, even deaths, the Berkeley campus free speech movement of 64. By the way, many young people today may not even be aware of it, but I know that you were there, or you're originally from California, but were you there? Maybe you could answer that question later on. The political assassinations of Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, the Watergate scandal, and the resignation of President Richard Nixon. Kent, to what extent do those events provide context so better to understand where America is today, or do we need to go back even further in American history to understand? Please cast some light on this for me.
Well, those are all very complicated questions. I would say that fundamentally, there has always been a tendency in America for there to have been multiple views of where things ought to be heading and what kind of policies we have. The problem is, I think it's partly a result of technology, the very thing that has brought us together on this 8,000-kilometer distance. The technology has made it possible for almost anybody to express an opinion in almost any context. And everybody should be aware that when people are saying things, they aren't necessarily the experts they need to be. So there's an awful lot of misleading information on social media, at least in the United States, and I suspect everywhere in the world. And then the other part of technology, if I can call it that, is 24-hour-a-day news, which is constant in America, at least, and perhaps less so in Europe. But there's constant availability of news. And quite often, the reporters are, shall we say, showing their own prejudices, or they're not offering variants of the different explanations they could for various phenomena. So technology is an important fact. Now, of course, in America, there's been since the very beginning, immigration into America by everybody, practically, except for the poor Native Americans who have lost out. The problem is that most Americans are not aware of the background of their own history. And I think that's a shame, and I don't know whether to blame the education system, but for sure we have to look back to well before the American Revolution and to the importation of slaves and so forth and so on to really understand the current problems in America. But throughout...
And you're saying, sorry to interrupt, but you're saying that is this comprehensive view of history isn't taught so well in schools, generally speaking.
Well, I don't know. I haven't been in school in such a long time. All I know is that when I've spoken with my grandchildren who are going through education, they're certainly getting American history. They're moving towards global history, which is very important. I think Americans need to have a much better grasp of what's happening in the rest of the world. But I suspect there's a reluctance on the part of some teachers to really go into detail, because almost anything you say in America now as a teacher, a parent's going to come into you and say, wait a second, you're not supposed to talk about that, or you've given a totally different view from mine, and so forth and so on. So therefore, teachers and educational institutions in America generally have to be a little bit more cautious about the kind of controversies they can address.
I see.
I don't remember that when I was a student. I don't remember big focus on controversy. Obviously, you learn about the Civil War and you learn about the Revolution and you learn about the Spanish-American War and so forth and so on, but not put in the context of how difficult was it for American politicians and leaders to make decisions based on the information they have.
I see.
And I don't think there's enough analysis of that.
Okay. Ken, look, when we last discussed this subject, exactly 1 week after Donald Trump was elected in November 2016, you said, and I remember your words quite clearly, that Donald Trump was probably as surprised as most people that he was elected, even though he lost the popular vote. Now, he's a unique political phenomenon, at least in modern times. We can't ignore that. So I want to spend a little time looking back over those 4 years, in particular Trump's high points and low points. Did he keep his promises, in your opinion? Or put another way, how many promises, in your opinion, did he keep? I have in mind to name just two, and we talked about them 4 years ago, the wall along the Mexican border that he promised to build and get the Mexican government to pay for, and bringing jobs back to America to help working people. I mean, you know the list. What's your assessment of Trump's highs and lows in short?
Well, first of all, I would say that one of his lows is his personality. He's very abrasive, he's insensitive, and therefore brought a lot of problems on himself by not being very clear about what he was saying or to show that he really did care about ethnic groups in America. And that may reflect his desire to play to his audience among the conservatives in America. But basically, until recently, at least, he tended to shoot from the hip and to say things that didn't really help his own cause. So that's the negative.
Yeah.
In the positive realm, he would say, and this a lot of people may not have regarded this as positive, he did an enormous amount of tax reformation, and many fewer Americans are paying their taxes these days than they had to. And that has stimulated the economy. The stock market has gone completely crazy. That kind of economic, if that's economic progress or financial progress, I don't know, but that has done a lot to make many people very rich, more people who already had money than people who didn't have money. But nevertheless, he did a lot of things on the economy. He tried to tackle the problem of immigration, as is Biden now going to be facing. Those were a number of the smaller things that he's done that I think he deserves a lot of credit for.
Okay, that's good to know. Now, Ken, you live in Florida, as I said at the beginning. From your perspective there, how would you describe America's condition leading up to and immediately after the presidential election, and then during that period between Election Day last November and the presidential inauguration on the 20th of January, in particular, on that unforgettable 6th of January when an armed mob raided the Capitol building? Should I call that a pivotal day? Would that be an exaggeration? Would you call it pivotal? And many people called it an insurrection, as you know. What's your analysis of what went on that day? And just please share your insights with me, please.
Well, I was not watching a lot of television during that period. And I think that a lot of the television coverage was distorted a little bit. As usual, I blame a lot of America's problems on journalists and editors exaggerating stories and trying to sell newspapers and sell TV time by therefore making a subject or an event even more of a dramatic thing than it should be.
But it happened. It seemed dramatic on the screen, Kent.
Yes, I know. And you could make almost any event look dramatic, and it was dramatic, actually. I don't mean to downplay it, but it was not something that I would call pivotal. I would say it was dangerous in many ways. This was anarchy for many people. And the question has been, did Trump inspire this? And to a certain extent, he did. But I wouldn't try to blame him for leading it. I would say he gave some speeches that made some of his supporters outraged. And at some point, he even said, please stop or go home or something like that, tried to quiet it down when he realized it was a political disaster for him. But we're still waiting to see the outcome of all this. There's still some investigating going on. There's still some research going on who the people were that were involved in this. As I say, they were anarchists, apparently from the right, but the accusation has been that many from the left, and I don't like to use those terms because nobody knows what it means, or at least everybody has different agreements, there were people on the left who probably joined in because they were professional anarchists themselves. There were tremendous outbreaks in various cities in the United States even before that.
Yes.
So that kind of violence caught on, and that kind of lack of respect for the law caught on and is remaining to be a problem and could still be a problem depending on how Biden handles it.
Okay, slightly different question, Ken. When you were last on my show, 2016, you expressed your worry about the increasing divide between rural and urban America, you may remember. How does the political and economic landscape look from where you live now in such a vast continental country? And if I asked you, maybe unfairly, to slice the USA into sections, what would those sections be, and how would you describe what's going on in each of them?
Well, for sure, there is an urban-rural divide, but that's always been the case in America. You could even say, well, there's a class divide, underprivileged, privileged, or middle class and upper class and lower class. There's all kinds of ways to divide it up. Geographically, it's rather important because some of the states, including Florida, is conservative and are conservative, continue to support Trump. And other important states such as Texas and Louisiana and various places have the same feeling. Those are in the South. And then in the North, especially along the coast and in the California, you have the, quote, headquarters of the liberal elite. And so there's still an attempt to by people to classify regions by their elitism, if that's the word. And that's a problem because they're obviously mixed. And the question would be, is where in America are they going to find common ground if there are divisions that are geographic as they were in the World Civil War period?
I see. Well, Ken, just link to that. Another question, and we can't avoid this kind of debating point when I do these sorts of interviews. Is there a serious chance, in your opinion, of organized gun violence between factions in certain parts of your country? The American population is, after all, very heavily armed. And yesterday's tragic killing in Atlanta of 8 women, though apparently of racist motivation than political, was yet another example of the sort of deadly illness of the lack of gun control in America. Please share your thoughts with me on that.
Well, I absolutely agree that some serious gun control has to be brought about, and I think Biden would like to do that, and many Republicans would like to do it too. But the problem is that there's so too many guns. I mean, and many, many guns, I don't know what the percentage is, are held illegally or unregistered. And probably the guns that would not be under control are those out of the hands of people that... So it's the bad guys that have the guns, but exactly. So some good guys feel scared, so they get their guns. And there's too many guns, and the question is kinds of guns. In my view, there needs to be more control over what you might call the large assault rifles.
These military-grade weapons.
Right. I see absolutely no reason why those are needed. Now, some of my own neighbors here would disagree with that. But nevertheless, it seems to me a reasonable thing to do. There is the Second Amendment of the Constitution, which guarantees the right to keep and bear arms. That was originally established so that the people could overthrow the government if they wanted to.
In the absence of a well-organized militia, isn't there some phrase that goes on in that
yes,
amendment?
Yes, there is something. I can't remember the exact wording, but that's important. And militias can be organized and exist in America. And they are probably in the control of a lot of weapons. But the question I think you're asking is, could the current difficulties, could the current disagreements, which are very, very broad between right and left, could they be resolved through military force or weapons? I hope not. I wouldn't exclude that possibility. And that's going to be something that Biden and his future presidents will have to deal with.
I'm not sure who could cut the Gordian knot on that one, Ken, but it really sounds like a very difficult problem. My guest today is the Honorable Kent Brown, former U.S. ambassador to the Republic of Georgia and a more than 25-year career diplomat at the United States State Department with wide international experience. Kent, let's turn to something slightly different. Has America stumbled? I mean, is my choice of word unfair? In your opinion, is the American dream out of reach from a growing number? And is that growing number increasingly an underclass of poor whites who resent competition from migrants for jobs and housing? And is it not the case that the underclass in America were once mainly black or brown, but are now increasingly white or even pink?
That's probably true. I would want to study the statistics very carefully. Definitely there's an underclass or people who are in a very bad economic situation, and that's increasing. There's an increasing division between those who have money and those that don't. And there's an outrageous number of people who have incredible amounts of money. Now, I know that Biden is talking about changing the tax, and I don't know if you were to take every rich person in America, however you define that, and decide to take away 90% of his income and redistribute it, you wouldn't have enough to build a few schools. I mean, it's just outrageous to think that you can correct the problems that America has by changing changing the tax system. What you need, I think, is to encourage people to understand and to listen to each other on the issues of wealth and the issues of race as being one of them. But you're right about one thing, that the Trump supporters especially the working class, or what used to be the working class, felt they were being discriminated against, and in fact they were. They weren't being discriminated against intentionally, but the elitists, shall we say, the swamp people in Washington, were not taking into account or even thinking about their interests when they made decisions about various issues. And so I think that the events will force some of these politicians to pay more attention to that particular group of people.
Mm. Very wise. We can't have a discussion about America without talking a little bit about race. Would you agree with me that racism still infects many parts of American society today, and that America, or parts of it, has never really come to terms with its awful history of slavery and oppression? We touched on it just earlier. And yet the variety of racial mixture and skin colors I observed on TV across America in support of the Black Lives Matter marches triggered by the police killing, as you know, of George Floyd, and here in a way I argue against my own question, seem to indicate that maybe, just maybe, the public sentiment and desire for change is different this time, better and more widespread. What's your impression about the present state of race relations in the USA today?
Well, I think there's a lack of understanding of especially among the white Northern Europeans, of the other ethnic groups in the United States. Some of them feel challenged and threatened by increasing immigration, that's true. But by and large, they don't have a lot of exposure to each other. Now, I could be wrong. In Florida here, there doesn't seem to be much interaction between the different races and the different peoples. The neighborhood I live in here is almost all Northern European white. But that's just an accident of the immigration, of the way in which Americans moved here, that came mostly from the North. But the most important thing is for people to listen to each other, it seems to me, and to take into account, and if you watch TV here, you hear Black speakers and Latino speakers talking about their situation. But somehow that's not a one-on-one situation where an individual can hear and discuss the issues. They're not listening to each other. They're talking around each other.
Yeah. Ken, we've got about a few minutes left, and we've got to talk about Joe Biden a bit more, in a bit more depth. What does Joe Biden need to do now domestically and by 2024, in your opinion? Can he do it, and what would it take? And by the way, John Wood, my previous guest and someone you know, referred to Joe Biden as a lame duck president because of his age. Because of his age, it's unlikely he'll run for a second term, so John surmised. What do you think? And what difference is Biden's age going to make to his strategy as president over the next 4 years?
I think his biggest challenge is the, I would say, I don't know what to call it, the left wing of the Democratic Party. He is a moderate, he's a reasonable man, he wants to change things, but he's being drawn by part of his party in one direction, which is not going to make it easier for him to present himself to the American public as a moderate. So that's the first thing he's going to do. He is, after all, anti-Trump. He is the alternative to Trump. People have to get over that. They have to realize that Biden is his own man. He's not just an anti-Trump figure. He's a character who can actually lead the country out of trouble, which isn't going to be easy anyway, because the troubles are enormous. Economic problems are very serious. He is talking, as I said, about tax increases. I don't think he can make a tax increase that will really work to the way he would like. But anyway, he's going to pursue that because his, among other things, the more progressive elements of the Democratic Party want to pursue a more leveling policy. And whether or not you like it or whether or not they like it, America is always going to be a country where many people have a lot of money and other people don't have as much. The problem is that the middle class in between those two seems to be shrinking.
Yeah. Ken, you've spent a large part of your professional life representing the best interests of the USA abroad. So let's, for the remainder of our conversation, address foreign policy and look ahead before we close. How do you see the USA's leadership of the free world looking from now, from 2021, and its relations with its economic competitor, China, not forgetting Europe, Russia, the Middle East, NATO, etc. But let's first, as time is short, take China. What type of diplomacy, in your opinion, is most effective with this rising power?
Well, that's a very good question, because China is indeed the biggest challenge to America and to the rest of the world. They're incredibly dynamic. They've got their act together, shall we say. They're doing all kinds of things. For example, they've got this road they're building between China and Europe, the Silk Road. They call it the New Silk Road. This is an attempt, and a so far successful attempt by the Chinese to expand their power and influence. Now, the problem in the case of U.S.-China relations is that U.S. doesn't want to see the Chinese expand their influence, certainly not by military power. But they can't stop it, because the Chinese are the skill, they're in the seat, they're in the driver's seat. They're the ones who can determine whether they can succeed or not. So America has to be prepared to compete with China, which is not easy. And besides the competition part, there's the potential threat that the Chinese pose to China's or to America's allies, Japan, South Korea.
Taiwan.
Yes. And Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
So many problems, and you may have seen or noticed or read that the Americans, the Indians, the Japanese, and the Australians have formed a new quadrilateral group.
Yes, I saw that.
They don't say specifically, I don't think, that it's aimed at China, but they're trying to develop a security regional system which will help them fend off Chinese influence.
Yeah, I see. Now, to Europe, Ken, in particular, the European Union, how do you think the White House will view the EU politically and economically as both an ally and a competitor? And if I just link to that, because somehow they are linked, if we have to take Russia seriously, I mean, it's economically underdeveloped, not even in the top 10 when I last looked economically. Little sign of improvement under Vladimir Putin, but you know that country well, you live there. They're all the top tables in global forums, and their influence in the Middle East is now has to be taken very seriously. How do you think Biden needs to calibrate or recalibrate U.S. relations with Moscow, and does the EU fit in somehow to that broader policy? It's a rather complex question.
Well, the EU will fit into that policy. There's this issue of the pipeline between Russia and Germany, which the Americans think is a big mistake and think that it's going to give Russia incredible influence over Europe in terms of energy supply. I would say the Germans should, their interests have to be taken into account when we calculate the U.S. policy on that issue. Now, what just happened yesterday, I think, was Biden was quoted as saying he thought Putin was a killer, or somebody asked him, do you think Putin is a killer? Somebody on ABC News. And he said, yes, I do, which is not a very wise thing to say. I mean, the Russians have pulled their ambassador out of Washington because of this, although I'm sure just temporarily. Then there's the issue of Russian interference, so-called, in the American elections. Indeed, the Russians no doubt did whatever they could, which was not much, not to encourage Trump, but to discourage the Democrats, because the Democrats, the left in America, has proven to be the most anti-Russian group in the United States, and that's shown by their activities in Congress. So there's a bunch of problems that Biden faces, and one of the reasons he wants to seem that he's tough on the Russians is because of his left wing of his party. But he also is concerned and should be concerned about Russia's relationship with China. And I personally do not think it's a serious threat to America, but they're certainly doing whatever they can to agree with each other on various issues. And Russians have quite often, and I think from the other side as well, found the Chinese to be a threat. And what I think John Wood mentioned is that Trump saw Russia as a possible counterweight to China.
That's correct, too.
Biden would be wise to follow that kind of an attitude.
And just a closing word on the Middle East, because America's always had a great interest in that part of the world with Israel and all the Gulf states. But now Russia has to be taken seriously there, too.
Yes, indeed. Now, one of the factors that people sometimes don't pay attention to is that the United States under Trump has developed a lot of energy independence through what do they call that when they're digging holes in the ground and developing energy sources.
Word has escaped me as well for the moment, yes. But it'll come to me.
Yes. Anyway, the U.S. has reduced its economic dependence upon the Middle East. The U.S. has pursued a very wise policy of encouraging many Arab states to join up with Israel on a number of mostly trade relationships. And finally, the most important issue for the Arabs and the Americans and the Israelis is the extension of power and influence by Iran. And I don't see any end to that problem because I don't think the Iranians are prepared in any way to show any kind of willingness to compromise on, first of all, nuclear weapons, but also on their activities that have to do with extending their influence.
Ken, thanks. I'm embarrassed that I had a mental block on that word at the same time that you did, but it'll come to me as soon as I switch off the microphone. Ken, thanks so much for answering my questions so candidly and thoughtfully. It's been really a pleasure listening to you, and I could really listen to you much longer. My guest today has been the Honorable Kent Brown, the United States' first ambassador to Georgia, to the Republic of Georgia, after the fall of the Soviet Union, and a professional diplomat for almost 30 years. Kent Brown, thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael, and all the best to you and the rest of your audience.
Thank you.
That was The McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.